Thank you, Tony. Well, this year has officially been named the World Year of Physics in honor of the 100th anniversary of Einstein's miraculous year in 1905. In fact, just 2 days ago marked the 50th anniversary of Einstein's death. Now, one of Einstein's major breakthroughs in 1905 was his formulation of special relativity, which unified space and time into one entity we now call space-time. So what I'd like to do today is to give you a modern view of space-time. I'll begin by reviewing the picture of space-time that we have through Einstein's general theory of relativity, and then describe the picture of space-time which is emerging from current work in string theory. So, actually, since I'm still getting set up here, I'll just take... Okay, the key idea of general relativity is the following. Since gravity is universal, it affects all objects in exactly the same way, we should identify it with something else which is universal, namely the geometry of space-time itself. So in other words, the distance between events becomes a dynamical field, and we identify that field with gravity. One can even take the view that in general relativity, there's no such thing as gravity. What we call gravity is just a manifestation of the curvature or the geometry of space and time. Now, there's a standard way to picture this, which is used all the time, so let me just remind you, and that's picturing space as a rubber sheet. So in general relativity, matter tells space how to curve. If you have a heavy mass, such as the sun, it curves the space around it. And similarly, the curved space tells matter how to move. A lighter object moving in the vicinity of the sun is bent, not because of any mysterious force at a distance, but because it's responding to the local curvature of space and time. Now, some of the key results which have come out of general relativity are the following. First of all, we have the singularity theorems. In the 1960s, Penrose and Hawking proved a series of remarkable theorems showing that gravitational collapse and cosmology generically lead to singularities. These singularities are typically spaces where the density diverges, the local curvature becomes infinite, and general relativity breaks down. So in some sense, general relativity predicts its own demise. It cannot evolve past these singularities. And the surprising thing about these singularity theorems was that they didn't assume any symmetry. They were quite general and very powerful results. A second result, which is much older, is that there's a standard initial value formulation in general relativity. You can specify data at one moment of time and evolve and obtain solutions of Einstein's equations, solutions of general relativity. So in that respect, it's quite a conventional theory. But in that evolution, the topology of space cannot change. So the geometry, the shape of space, certainly does change. That's talking about the evolving gravitational field. But the way the space is connected, how many handles it has, and things like that, cannot change under the evolution predicted by general relativity. Of course, general relativity predicts black holes, and studies of black holes in general relativity have shown they have a number of very special properties. It's been shown that the horizon must be topologically a sphere. It can turn out to be distorted, especially for rotating black holes and things like that, but it's always the topology of just an ordinary two-sphere. It's also been shown that the geometry around a black hole is uniquely characterized by just a few parameters: the mass, angular momentum, and if there is charge, if we allow electric charge on the black hole, then that can be a parameter as well. But these few parameters uniquely determine the geometry, and this is what John Wheeler referred to as black holes have no hair. And finally, black holes are stable. That's why we're interested in them in physical objects. Small perturbations remain small. Now, it's long been expected that quantum gravity will provide a change in our view of space and time even more radical than that provided by general relativity. And string theory is a promising candidate for a quantum theory of gravity. And what I'd like to do now is to tell you a little bit about string theory and then describe what it has to say about space-time. Well, as everybody knows, string theory starts with the idea that point particles are not really point-like, but should be replaced by one-dimensional extended objects, which are the strings. And if you quantize a string in flat space, the first thing you realize is that the string is not consistent in the usual three dimensions of space that we're familiar with. It actually predicts that space has higher dimensions. The second thing you notice when you quantize a string in flat space is that there's a tachyon, a particle of negative mass squared indicating some type of instability. And to remove the tachyon and to gain better control over the theory, people add fermions and impose supersymmetry. So string theory naturally incorporates two extensions of the space-time of general relativity, which were discussed and developed long before string theory itself became popular in the mid-1980s. The idea that space might have more than three dimensions goes back to the 1920s and the work of Kaluza and Klein, and the standard explanation for why we don't see these extra dimensions is just that they're curled up into a very, very small space, and it would take incredibly high energy to see it. Supersymmetry is often described as a symmetry between bosons and fermions, but in fact, it's a lot more than that. It's not just a symmetry of bosons and fermions. It's an extension of the Poincaré symmetry of space-time. And in that sense, it represents the first extension of space-time since space and time themselves were unified by Minkowski. Some people describe this as having extra fermionic dimensions of space-time, but it really is an extension of the basic symmetries of space-time and not just another internal symmetry group of elementary particles. Now, one thing that's become clear in the past decade or so is that string theory is not just a theory of strings. There are other extended objects in this theory which play a role as important as the fundamental strings, and these are called brains. Now, the name comes from membrane, which connotes a two-dimensional extended surface, but the brains in string theory can come in various dimensions. So there are zero brains, which is just a fancy word for, again, a point particle. There are one brains, two brains, three brains, etc. And the key feature of these brains is that there are surfaces on which open strings can end. So normally, we think about the string as being a closed loop like this, and then it can move anywhere it wants in space-time. But if a string is open and has two endpoints, those endpoints have to live on one of these surfaces called the brain. Now, it's believed that quarks, leptons, and in fact, all the particles we know of in the standard model come from open strings. And so this has led to a whole new way of thinking about extra dimensions in string theory, called the brain world models. And the idea is that we might be living on a three brain in a higher dimensional space. So the space doesn't have to be curled up into a very small ball. The extra dimensions might be quite large. The fact that we haven't seen them is just reflecting the fact that all the particles of the standard model are confined to move on a three-dimensional surface. And only particles associated with the closed string can sort of probe the extra dimensions, and that includes gravity. So the graviton, the sort of quantum of gravity, comes from the closed string in string theory. And so gravity, in fact, sees everything, but the other particles see only the three brain. Now, the fact that these brain worlds allow gravity to have extra dimensions has led to a investigation of the properties of black holes in higher dimensions. And it soon became clear that black holes in more than three spatial dimensions behave very differently than black holes that we're used to studying in general relativity. So first of all, they can have non-spherical topology. This was first shown by Ampron and Rial, and Rial is a postdoc here at the ITP, around here someplace. So what they showed is that in five space-time dimensions, four space and time, there are black rings. So you can think of this as a very long circle enclosed inside a very thin event horizon. So the topology is now an S2 cross an S1. And you might wonder why that ring doesn't collapse. Ordinary gravitational attraction would cause the ring to collapse just like any tension. The gravitational attraction, one part would on the other. But in fact, this ring is rotating. And the angular momentum is sufficient to balance the gravitational attraction. And there are stationary solutions. These are exact solutions known analytically of general relativity describing these rotating black rings, a qualitatively new type of black hole discovered just a few years ago. Another thing that these authors pointed out is that because of these new types of black holes are no longer characterized by just the parameters we're used to, the mass and angular momentum. In more than three spatial dimensions, you can have rotation in more than one orthogonal plane. So angular momentum is not characterized by just a single number, but by several numbers, talking about how much it's rotating in each of these possible different planes. But even including the fact that angular momentum is now described by several parameters, specifying the mass in these angular momenta do not uniquely determine the solution. There are some cases where you can have these rotating black rings and ordinary spherical type black holes with the same conserved quantities at infinity. And finally, it was pointed out that black holes in higher dimensions can be unstable. In the simplest case, you just take a sort of a black string, and that's just a one-dimensional extended object surrounded by an event horizon. And it was shown by Gregory and Laflamme about 10 years ago that that solution is unstable. There are linearized perturbations which grow in time. So it's natural to ask, what does this settle down to? And in fact, despite the fact that this has been known for, well, in fact, more than 10 years now, it's closer to 15 years since this instability was first found, it's still not known what the end state of this instability is. Many of us have thought about it. There's been some numerical work to try to figure it out, but it's still an open question. Okay, I don't want to say anything more about this, because although these are sort of interesting, surprising properties of black holes, they're really just a reflection of general relativity in higher dimensions. What I want to spend my time on is telling you about some of the deeper, more fundamental changes in space-time that are coming out of string theory. So let me divide the rest of the discussion up into two parts, one which will be based on the perturbative string theory and one which will be based on a non-perturbative understanding of the theory. Even at a perturbative level, there have been several surprises. We're going to see, I'll discuss this, that geometrically different space-times can be equivalent in string theory. In general relativity, if the two space-times have different geometry, if they have different curvature, those are physically different situations. They have different gravitational fields. But in string theory, that's not the case. In some instances, geometrically different space-times are actually completely equivalent. We'll see that some singularities can be resolved. So string theory improves upon general relativity. In cases where general relativity would break down, string theory, in some cases, doesn't have any problem. And finally, we'll see that the topology of space can change. Unlike general relativity, where the way the space is connected is fixed once and for all, in string theory, there are allowed transitions from one topology to another. The non-perturbative theory is not completely understood. Much work is going on to try to improve that. But at the present time, the most important lesson, which has come out of a non-perturbative understanding of string theory, is this idea of holography. And the sort of most concrete application of that is something called the ADS-CFT correspondence. So I'm going to explain a little bit what that is. And finally, at the end, I'd like to say a few words about some recent work describing or trying to understand cosmological singularities in string theory. Okay, so let me start with the perturbative string theory. So one starts by fixing a space-time. So one has some space-time with some metric. And a string, being a one-dimensional extended object, traces out a two-dimensional world sheet in time, in space-time. And the perturbative string theory describes how this world sheet is moving in space-time. So So it's convenient to introduce an auxiliary metric, this extra metric QAB living on the world sheet. But the important sort of dynamics is carried by this embedding, how the world sheet is embedded in space-time. So the perturbative theory is governed by a two-dimensional theory. And the two-dimensional theory has an action. And this is essentially the only equation in the talk. So I just thought I should give you one. So the action is called the sigma model. It has a dimensionful parameter in front, which is the string length. L sub s is a characteristic length scale associated with the tension of the string. But the rest of this, there's just some covariant integral. And then it's basically just quadratic. It's the derivatives of these embedded variables squared. And the space-time metric comes in here, which itself can depend on x, because x should be thought of as just coordinates on your space-time. Now, this action is classically invariant under rescaling Q. But it turns out that when you quantize this, that symmetry is in general broken. And requiring that rescaling symmetry remain quantum mechanically yields a field equation on G. It yields a field equation on the background metric, which turns out to reproduce Einstein's equation to leading order. So even though one doesn't start with general relativity, one gets it back just by quantizing a string, just by demanding that this rescaling or conformal invariance is preserved quantum mechanically. Now, this approach is called perturbative because different topologies for the string world sheet. I showed a simple cylinder on the previous slide, but if you imagine more complicated topologies for the world sheet with various handles, those correspond to different loops in a quantum expansion, in a quantum loop expansion. But already we see a key point. The role of space-time has changed dramatically from that of general relativity. In general relativity, one deals with fields propagating on space-time, or the space-time metric itself evolving. And now we're focused on these strings moving in space-time. And the metric plays the role of a coupling constant as far as this two-dimensional field theory is concerned. And that has a key consequence. Since the string only senses space-time through this two-dimensional sigma model, two metrics which yield the same sigma model are indistinguishable in string theory. And apparently trivial changes to the sigma model can result in dramatic changes to space-time. So let me give you a couple examples of what I mean by this. So the first is an example of this fact I mentioned, that geometrically different space-times can be equivalent. And this is known as t-duality in string theory. So the way it goes is that if the space-time has a symmetry around a circle, so it has a symmetry in which you go around the circle and nothing changes, there's essentially a change of variables in the sigma model, which produces a new space-time where that circle has a different radius. Okay, the physics of the sigma model doesn't depend on this change of variables. So as far as the sigma model is concerned, it's the same two-dimensional theory, but its interpretation as a string in a space-time gives you a different space-time. So for example, if you have flat space-time compactified on a circle of radius r, in other words, just think about it as, say, ordinary flat space across a circle of radius r, that is completely equivalent to flat space across a circle where the radius now is this string scale, ls squared, divided by r. So large radii are completely equivalent to small radii. Now, how can that be? Well, physically, it's a result of the fact that strings have two kinds of modes when they propagate on a circle. There are the usual modes, where the string is some small object and it's just moving around the circle. Those objects have energies which are proportional to 1 over r, because it's just the same as point particles. Momentum is quantized in units of 1 over the radius. But since the string is an extended object, there are also now these winding modes, where the string winds around the circle, and those states have energies proportional to r. So when you change the actual physical radius from r to 1 over r, all you're doing is essentially interchanging the role of these winding modes and momentum modes. The spectrum is completely invariant, and one can show that all the interactions are invariant. And so strings just can't tell the difference between these two spacetimes. Well, here's another example. Topologically different spacetimes can be equivalent. And this is known in the trade as mirror symmetry. So I've been talking about these extra dimensions, and I said that the standard way of dealing with them before all these brain worlds came around was to imagine that they were just curled up and very small. So people studied the geometry of these small spaces that you can consistently add in string theory, and they considered spacetimes which were flat, Minkowski space, cross one of these compact spaces curled up that I'll call K. And now it turns out that basically by changing a sign in the sigma model, changes its interpretation from strings on a spacetime which is four-dimensional Minkowski space cross one of these spaces, K, to strings on four-dimensional Minkowski space cross a different K, K prime, where K and K prime are topologically different spaces. Now these spaces have to satisfy certain properties, and the ones that do are called Calabi-Yau spaces. So these are just two different Calabi-Yau spaces which are different not only in their geometry but also in their topology. But this sign is totally irrelevant as far as the sigma model is concerned. So again, string theory just can't tell the difference. Now this led to a dramatic prediction. Soon after this idea of mirror symmetry was proposed in the early 1990s, Candelis and al. Did a calculation in which they did a sort of fairly straightforward string calculation on M4 cross K, and then reinterpreted it as a calculation on M4 cross K prime, and were led to this prediction that the number of ways of mapping certain surfaces into this Calabi-Yau space were the following. So these are different surfaces. They're rational curves of degree n. It's a technical definition. But they're just sort of different ways of mapping two-dimensional surfaces into the space. And you see that the numbers grow very rapidly. You know, this one is 2,875, and pretty soon you're up to millions and billions, etc. And they had predictions for all n. Now at the time, in early 1990, mathematicians were also interested in this question of how many ways there were of mapping surfaces, two-dimensional surfaces, into the space, but they had only been able to calculate the answer for n equals 1 and n equals 2. In fact, I'm told they even had it wrong for n equals 2, but that's beside the point. Anyway, their tools were just not powerful enough to calculate this beyond n equals 2. But motivated by this string theory prediction, the mathematicians then developed much more powerful tools. And by the end of the decade, by the late 1990s, they had in fact confirmed all of these numbers for all n using their own sort of techniques. Okay, now what about singularities? Well, I said that string theory can resolve certain singularities. So here are examples of some of the singularities that are just not a problem for string theory. General relativity would break down, but string theory is perfectly okay. The first is sort of mild. These are sort of generalizations of conical singularities, known in string theory as orbifolds. Folds. These are just spaces that you get when you take a sort of flat space and you identify points under some discrete symmetry. So you get something like a cone, and there's conical singularities at the vertex. The curvature is not blowing up, but nonetheless, general relativity has problems when that happens because particles who hit that singularity just don't know where to go, and they sort of get stuck. But strings, being extended objects, go right through. And it was shown that there's no problem evolving strings in spacetimes with these conical-like singularities. But it's also been shown that singularities associated with certain types of topology change are completely innocuous in string theory. There are various examples of this. The earliest examples had to do with the topology of this internal space, this Calabi-Yau space I mentioned. So there were calculations showing that you could have one of these spaces actually continuously change its topology. So that would mean that some handle could sort of shrink down to zero size and disappear, or could blow up in a different way. And that transition was completely smooth as far as the string theory was concerned. Just a few months ago, there was an exciting new example of this topology change by Eva Silverstein and her colleagues at Stanford, in which she just took, again, a sort of a simple handle and showed that in some case, when that handle gets very small, it breaks. It just sort of pinches off, and she could describe that smoothly in string theory in a way that just is not possible in general relativity. And finally, there are these so-called time-like singularities associated with extended objects. Now, these are the brains that I mentioned that come into the brain world idea. The brains themselves produce a gravitational field. In general relativity, if you write that down, you would find a singularity at the location of the brain, much like an electron being a point charge is a singularity for the electric field classically. In general relativity, we would have no way of sort of dealing with that. That would just be a singularity in the solution. But in string theory, we know how to deal with that. The physics near the brain should be interpreted in terms of these excitations of the brain, in terms of little open strings moving around the brain. And we can resolve the singularity, understand the physics near the singularity that way. Well, results like this have led some people to believe, and some even to state publicly, that string theory resolves all singularities, that there just won't be any problems with singularities in string theory. But that's certainly false. In fact, it's been known to be false for over 10 years. It turns out that there are solutions corresponding to gravitational plane waves. Now, these are not the linearized gravitational waves that sort of everyone studies when they talk about, you know, spin 2 and LIGO and things like that. There are sort of nonlinear gravitational plane waves with large amplitudes which solve the exact nonlinear field equations of general relativity exactly. And it turns out also solve the full equations of string theory exactly. Okay, so these are solutions of string theory, but the amplitude of the wave is still arbitrary. So there's an arbitrary function describing the amplitude of the wave, and then the wave just propagates along. And if this amplitude diverges, then the solution is singular. It's singular in a sense appropriate to general relativity because the curvature is actually diverging, but it turns out that you can show that it's singular even in string theory. Okay, so this is work I did with a student in the early 90s, but it's just an example of a situation where we have a singularity in an exact solution of string theory which is not resolved by any string theory effects. And in fact, one can argue that it's a good thing that string theory doesn't resolve all singularities, because if all singularities were resolved, spacetimes with negative total energy would be allowed. And then Minkowski space would be unstable. There would be no ground state, no lowest energy state. In general relativity, you can find a solution with negative total energy, and asymptotically, it's perfectly fine. The curvature is very small and everything. But when you come into the center, you find one of these singularities. If that singularity was resolved in string theory, this negative energy, negative mass solution would be perfectly smooth and regular in string theory, and we would have no ground state. So it had better not be true that all singularities are resolved. Now, of course, the key question are sort of the physically most interesting singularities, are these cosmological and black hole singularities, and we'd like to know whether those are resolved or not in string theory. And that's something which is currently an active area of research, and I'm going to come back to this at the end of the talk and tell you a little bit more about it. Okay, so that completes what I wanted to say about the perturbative, the lessons of string theory that we can learn from perturbative string theory. And now I want to turn to non-perturbative theory. Well, as I said, this theory is not understood completely in the non-perturbative setting, but the main lesson which has emerged so far is this idea of holography. And roughly speaking, this is a statement that physics in some region of space is completely described by fundamental degrees of freedom living on the boundary of this region. And the idea is not that space and time are going to emerge from strings, but rather that space and time and strings themselves are all derived from this fundamental degrees of freedom living on the boundary. So everything we know about string theory in this approach are derived from more fundamental degrees of freedom living on the boundary. Well, this is a vague idea. It had various motivations. Coming from black hole physics that led to Hooft and Seskind to propose it initially in the early 90s. But the most concrete and clear manifestation of this is the so-called ADS-CFT correspondence proposed by Maldacena in 1997. So what does this mean? Well, ADS stands for anti-de Sitter spacetime. This is the maximally symmetric spacetime with negative curvature. That's negative cosmological constant. Now, I realize that's the wrong sign as far as the astrophysicists are concerned. They've recently given us strong evidence that the universe has a positive cosmological constant. Now, string theory is, well, there are some things we understand about string theory in space-time with positive cosmological constant, but it's a much less complete story. And so I'm going to describe this case of negative cosmological constant as a model for how quantum gravity can change space-time structure, not as a model for what the world really is. Okay, we're not going to propose that the world really has negative cosmological constant in string theory, but this is just a wonderful laboratory to study effects of quantum gravity in a way that we have more control than in the case of positive cosmological constant. Okay, so we're going to be working with space-times which at least asymptotically approach this anti-de Sitter space. Now the other half, the CFT, stands for conformal field theory. So that's an ordinary, i.e. non-gravitational field theory, which is conformally invariant. Invariant under sort of conformal rescalings of the metric. And the statement of this correspondence is that string theory on space-times which asymptotically approach anti-de Sitter space cross some compact space K is completely described by a conformal field theory living on the boundary of this space at infinity. Now you can picture this ADS-CFT correspondence as follows. Okay, so the soup inside represents the physical space-time. It's really infinite in extent, but we can rescale space and bring infinity down to a finite distance just to represent it inside a finite cylinder. The label represents the CFT. It gives a description of what's inside. But unlike a true CFT, this is just a coarse-grained, crude approximation to what's inside, whereas in the ADS-CFT correspondence, the CFT is supposed to provide an actual microscopically exact description of everything happening inside the space. So one particular example of this ADS-CFT correspondence, there's various examples depending upon what you choose for K and what you choose for the dimension of your anti-de Sitter space, but one well-studied case is this one where you would require that the space asymptotically looks like a five-dimensional anti-de Sitter space across a five-dimensional sphere. And with those boundary conditions, the claim is string theory is completely equivalent to an ordinary four-dimensional supersymmetric UN gauge theory. Now, gauge theories are very well understood. It's the model of the sort of standard model of particle physics is formulated in terms of these gauge theories. So they've been well studied. In fact, supersymmetric gauge theories are even better behaved and better studied. So this is a well-studied theory. And the remarkable claim is that string theory is actually equivalent to this theory, which doesn't have any gravity in it and lives just in four dimensions. So, you know, the first reaction is, how can this be? This just seems absolutely crazy. And the reason it's not obviously wrong is that what we know best about each of these theories is what happens at weak coupling. That's the theory where we have our intuition. And the statement of this correspondence is that when the string theory is weakly coupled, the gauge theory is strongly coupled, and vice versa. So this is a strong weak coupling duality. And we don't have much independent information about either side when they're strongly coupled. In fact, Tehuf, back in the 1970s, had already suggested that when these gauge theories get strongly coupled, they should be describable in terms of some type of string theory. So among other things, this realizes that old idea of Tehuf. Okay, well that's why it's not obviously wrong, but why is it right? Well, there's lots and lots of evidence now for this conjecture. Since it was proposed in late 1997, literally thousands of papers have been written checking it in various ways. So let me just give a little bit of that evidence. So first of all, one of the things that, in fact, Maldacena noted in his original paper is that the symmetries of these two theories agree. On the string theory side, this SO4,2 cross SO6, this group is just the isometry group of the space. The five-dimensional sphere is invariant under all possible rotations of the sphere, It's sitting in a six-dimensional space, and so it has an SO6 symmetry. And similarly, the five-dimensional anti-de Sitter space is a very symmetric space, and it's invariant under this group SO4, 2. On the gauge theory side, you have exactly the same symmetries, but they come arise in a completely different way. So this supersymmetric gauge theory involves six scalars. There's a gauge field, of course, but there's also six scalars. And this SO6 symmetry is just rotations of those six scalars among themselves. The SO4, 2 symmetry is a conformal symmetry in four dimensions. Okay, so then it was noted early on that there are, in fact, gauge theory analogs of all the massless states of the string. So you put a string in this background, and it has various massless states, and one can explicitly write down the corresponding states in the gauge theory for each of those massless states. For a while, it was not clear how to describe all the massive states of the string, and of course, there's many of those. But recent work has shown that at least some of those states where there's a lot of angular momentum, so the string is either rapidly moving around the sphere or rapidly orbiting in this five-dimensional anti-de Sitter space, if the angular momentum is large, one can, in fact, write down explicitly the corresponding states in the gauge theory for describing those massive string modes. And in fact, with a little more work, one can actually write down from the gauge theory itself a two-dimensional theory describing these massive states, which turns out to be identical to the description of a string in ADS. So that's quite a clear correspondence in that case. And then it's not just the sort of individual modes of the string, but the interactions have to agree. And so some of the interactions of strings in ADS have been shown to agree with ordinary gauge theory type interactions. Well, as I said, there's lots of evidence, and I'm not going to go through all of it, but I wanted to mention something which happened recently. Just this past fall, there was a paper, again by Maldacena, Lin and Lunin, two colleagues at Princeton, finding or explicitly giving a correspondence for all states that preserve half of the supersymmetry of the problem. So let me just sort of outline how this goes. On the gauge theory side, these particular states are created by a single scalar field. So I said that the gauge theory has gauge fields and scalars. There are six scalars, but let's throw out five of them and just work with a single one. You have a single scalar field. It's defined on some space, but we ignore the spatial dependence as well. So now we have just basically a constant, but these are gauge fields, so they have to actually be n by n matrices. So they take values in the adjoint of un. So there's a single n by n matrix, and so this gauge theory reduces to what's called a matrix model for a single matrix. And that matrix model can be quantized exactly. And you can characterize the states by giving sort of closed regions in a two-dimensional plane. And the reason is that this matrix model, when you quantize it, can be expressed in terms of fermions. In fact, it's just free fermions. You can think of this two-dimensional space as the phase space for the fermions, and you're simply saying, where are the fermions in phase space? So what regions of phase space are occupied by the fermions? And by giving this description, simple sort of regions of a two-dimensional plane, you characterize the states of the fermions and therefore states in this gauge theory. So what's the analog on the string side? Well, in string theory, we have to deal with these 10-dimensional spaces, which have to be asymptotic to anti-de Sitter space across a sphere. But what that group showed was that for each of these states, for each of these semi-classical states, there is a corresponding gravity solution. It's stationary and non-singular anywhere, but in general has very complicated topology. And the key thing is that it's characterized by a solution to a three-dimensional linear equation. So these equations on the gravity side are complicated nonlinear equations in general, but they show that if you choose coordinates appropriately and impose the supersymmetry condition, then in fact all of those equations reduce to a single three-dimensional linear equation. And now that linear equation can have boundary conditions on a two-dimensional surface. And it turns out that in order for the solution to be non-singular, the field can only take two possible values on that surface. It can basically be +1 or -1. And if it was anything else, you would have singularities in the solution. So you again get a condition that all of these solutions are characterized by regions of the plane where this function is either plus one or minus one. And you can then map up very directly the states on the gauge theory with these complicated solutions on the gravity side. And then, for example, you can show that the curvature of this gravity solution is everywhere below the Planck scale, so everywhere sort of small compared to a quantum gravity scale, as long as the area enclosed by each loop is large enough. So as long as those loops are not too small, the curvature on the gravity side is small enough. And then, since there's such an explicit map between the solutions on the gravity side and the solutions on the gauge theory side, and we understand the gauge theory quantum mechanically, of course, on the gravity side, we don't understand the full quantum gravity directly on this side, because that would involve non-perturbative string theory. We understand this only through its description as a non-perturbative gauge theory. But it's natural to now, you know, conclude that the full quantum description of this sector of the theory is just given by the matrix model, because there's such an explicit correspondence between the two. Okay, well, that's enough for the evidence for this conjecture. What does it give you? Well, it gives you some resolutions of some long-standing black hole puzzles. Now, as you all know, back in the 70s, Hawking showed that black holes were not really black. Quantum mechanically, they emit particles. There's radiation associated with the black hole at a certain temperature, and that led to the idea that black holes have an entropy. And the entropy is given by the area of the black hole divided by 4 in Planck units. And this entropy is enormous. For ordinary solar mass black holes, it's like 10 to the 77 or something like that. And so it's been a long-standing challenge to find the microscopic origin of this entropy. Well, it turns out that that's easy in this case, because large black holes in this space, which is asymptotic to five-dimensional anti-de Sitter space, have an entropy, which is given by the area over 4, which actually grows like the temperature of the black hole cubed. But that's exactly the relation you would get for an ordinary thermal state in a four-dimensional gauge theory. So it says that the dual gauge theory naturally has enough states to explain the entropy of the black hole. I should say that this is a little bit surprising, because in ordinary flat space, as you make the black hole very large, the temperature goes down. And you certainly don't get any relation like this, where the entropy is proportional to some power of the temperature. But in anti-de Sitter space, black holes behave differently. A large black hole has a high temperature, a high Hawking temperature in a space which is asymptotically anti-de Sitter. And it turns out that their temperature, the entropy, as measured by the area of the black hole, grows like the right power of the temperature to be captured by the ordinary gauge theory sitting on the boundary. Okay, also you may have heard that there was a lot of commotion last summer about the black hole information puzzle. Hawking in the past had argued that black hole evaporation might violate quantum mechanics. But in this context, the formation and evaporation of a small black hole in a space which is asymptotic to anti-de Sitter space should be described by an ordinary Hamiltonian evolution in this dual field theory. It should be ordinary quantum mechanics. And in fact, I think it's based on the sort of power of these arguments coming from string theory that Hawking eventually announced last summer, that he agrees that there is no problem with violating quantum mechanics with black holes. Okay. What about getting beyond anti-de Sitter space? This is a wonderful laboratory. You can test various things, but it's not physics. We can't apply it to the real world. So we'd like to extend ADS-CFT to other boundary conditions. Well, one thing that was done, by David Berenstein, who's here on our faculty now, and his colleagues, is to take a certain limit of this space and obtain another kind of plane wave, a homogeneous plane wave. And this follows a procedure that Penrose described many years ago, that you can take a limit of a space-time and get a plane wave. But in this case, you can take the same limit of the gauge theory. And so you now have a correspondence between states in the gauge theory and states of a string in some plane wave background. And it turns out that in that case, one can say more. All of the massive excited states of the string in this background can be mapped into the gauge theory, and more of the interactions have been shown to agree. Okay, so that's nice. But can we extend AdS-CFT to asymptotically flat or cosmological spacetimes? Okay, that's really the key question. And, well, at the moment, we don't have an analogous statement as powerful as this for the asymptotically flat or cosmological case. So we have to do what we can. And so in the last few minutes, I'd like to describe some work I've been doing with my postdoc, Thomas Hertog, on how we can use AdS-CFT to say something about cosmological singularities. Okay, so the idea is the following. With a slight modification of the usual boundary conditions, you can find asymptotically anti-de Sitter initial data, which evolves to a big crunch. Okay, and by a big crunch, I mean a space-like singularity which extends all the way out to infinity in finite time. So there's initial data, which looks perfectly nice. It's asymptotically AdS. And you evolve it, and you develop a singularity. And that singularity doesn't stay localized inside some black hole, like most singularities are supposed to do. But this one will actually extend all the way out to infinity, cutting off all of space-time. So in that sense, it's directly analogous to a cosmological singularity, like a big crunch, which will cut off all of space at all and time. And of course, we can time reverse this and talk about a big bang if you'd rather than a big crunch. But it's just a little bit easier to talk about the big crunch side. But now the idea is, having a solution like this, which is asymptotically anti de Sitter, one can use this dual CFT to study what happens near the singularity in the full quantum theory. If in this ordinary field theory, there is a state which continues to evolve for all time, and if you can reconstruct something like a classical space-time metric at later times after the singularity, then we would learn that there's a bounce, that after this big crunch, there's another sort of classical space-time emerging from it. But if in the CFT you evolve a state and either you can't evolve past this time, or you evolve and you don't get any state which corresponds to a classical or semi-classical metric, then you would conclude that there isn't a bounce. So here's at least a context where we can try to say something concrete about that. This is just a picture of what this space-time looks like. It's a space-time diagram. Time's going vertical, space is horizontal. It's drawn so that light cones are at 45 degrees. So we have some initial data at some time here. Infinity is rescaled into a finite distance, so this is the asymptotic anti-de Sitter region. And the basic point is just that in a finite time, you reach a singularity, which is a big crunch in the future, which goes all the way across the space. And similarly, this initial data is in fact time symmetric. So you get the same solution evolving to the past, and you get a singularity, which you can call the Big Bang. Okay, so that's what it looks like from the gravity side. What about the dual field theory side? Well, our particular solution was in a space which was a four-dimensional anti-de Sitter space. So the boundary is a three-dimensional surface. And so what we get is a three-dimensional field theory. It's even simpler than a four-dimensional gauge theory, or one might hope, but it turns out it's not so simple. Anyway, the three-dimensional field theory corresponding to our big crunch is something analogous to this. This is a simplification, but it's roughly a scalar field theory with a potential which has a sort of an ordinary 1/2 m squared phi squared term, and then a minus constant over 3 phi to the sixth. And the classical solution, which evolves to a big crunch, basically corresponds to starting with phi at rest at this point and just letting it go. And of course, it rolls down the potential, and that on the gravity side is the evolution to the big crunch. Now, we know that in this field theory, phi equals 0 is a perturbatively stable vacuum, but non-perturbatively, it'll decay. And we know that in a semi-classical approximation, phi will tunnel through the barrier and then roll down to infinity in a finite time. So this barrier is steep enough that you actually roll down and hit infinity in a finite time. So it appears that the field theory evolution ends in finite time and that there's no bounce through the big crunch. That's sort of the first reaction thinking about this problem semi-classically. But of course, we don't want to think about it just semi-classically. We want to think about it as a full quantum theory. So what about the full quantum theory? Well, that's hard to analyze. So let's first restrict to just the homogeneous field configurations. it was the homogeneous field, basically just the constant, the field which did not depend on space, just time, which was the analog of evolving to the Big Crunch, so this doesn't seem too bad. If you stick to the homogeneous field configurations, then this field theory reduces to ordinary quantum mechanics, and the potential is the same, basically 1/2 m squared x squared times k over 3 x to the 6. So this is a quantum mechanics in a potential which is unbounded from below. Now this problem has been extensively studied. There's a nice paper that we used by Farhi et al. From MIT. But the conclusion is that evolution is not really unique in this quantum mechanics problem. The Hamiltonian, well, technically, it's not essentially self-adjoint, which means that you have to basically add boundary conditions at infinity, or you have to sort of make some choice of a self-adjoint extension in order to get a unique evolution. So there's only a one-parameter family of ambiguity, so it's not so bad. You can show there's only a one-parameter family of Hamiltonians for corresponding to this classical potential. And picking any one, you can show that the evolution continues for all time. Well, you now have a nice self-adjoint Hamiltonian, so there's evolution for all time. But the expectation value of x can diverge at certain times. It diverges and comes back. So that looks a lot like a bounce. The field goes off to infinity, it comes back, and you've just got sort of the space that you started with. So now you might wonder whether you're predicting a bounce. But the point is that this never happens, almost never happens in field theory. And the reason is simply that this field theory has infinitely many degrees of freedom. And even though you start with only exciting the sort of homogeneous mode, all these other modes become excited as you roll down the potential. So this is something which is known as tachyonic preheating in the cosmology literature. It's just the statement that the inhomogeneous modes are unstable and they become excited as you roll down. In terms of particles, it's like the particles decaying into lower and lower mass particles. Now, in the quantum mechanics problem, I said this ambiguity, this different self-adjoint extensions, correspond to different ways of cutting off the potential at some large value of x. And now if the same were possible in the field theory, one would expect to form a thermal state. This field would roll down, you would excite lots and lots of particles, and you'd end up with something like a thermal state at the end, and you certainly wouldn't get a bounce. The bounce would require all of those particles to somehow convert all their energy back into the zero mode and send the zero mode up the hill. Okay, that's just not going to happen. Okay, well, one can, in fact, I mean, given the time, let me just skip this. There's a little more you can say, but the key point is the following. This leads to a natural asymmetry between the Big Bang and the Big Crunch. So recall the Big Crunch idea is that you have the field up here. It evolves down the potential, and as it does, it creates lots and lots of particles. Okay, so that's rather a generic evolution through the Big Crunch. The Big Bang, being a time reverse, would require that you start with something like the thermal state down here and have a very rare fluctuation in which all of that energy gets converted back into the zero mode and causes the zero mode to shoot up the hill. Okay, that sounds like a very rare and unlikely event. Well, Penrose has argued for a long time that there should be a time asymmetry between the Big Bang and Big Crunch, or else we would never see a second law of thermodynamics. And this at least is, well, maybe one hint toward where that time asymmetry comes from. So one's led to the following picture. The universe can be thought of as starting in some approximately thermal state with all the Planck scale degrees of freedom excited. So that's this sort of state at the bottom here in the field theory, which we imagine corresponding to on the gravity side of all these Planck scale degrees of freedom excited in some way, which means there's no classical space-time at all, no space-time of general relativity, just some quantum mass. And very rarely, there's a fluctuation in which most of the energy gets put into the zero mode, causing it to go up the potential, and that's the Big Bang. It starts off in some rare fluctuation, and then it can evolve from there. So anyway, that's where we are. So let me summarize. What is space-time in string theory? Well, we've seen that perturbatively, the metric acts like a coupling constant in this two-dimensional field theory. And that leads to very different pictures of space-time, since you can have geometrically different space-times that are equivalent in string theory, topologically different space-times which are equivalent in string theory, and some singularities are just not there, not seen in string theory. Non-perturbatively, we've seen that space-time is not fundamental, but must be reconstructed from this holographic dual theory. I say at least in some cases, because we know that for sure in this case where your boundary conditions are given by anti-de Sitter space. It remains to be seen whether we can do this for other boundary conditions as well. And finally, well, some singularities are resolved, some are not. Progress is being made on these cosmological singularities, and so the theory is not complete. We don't have the final story, but the picture of space-time in string theory is still fuzzy since we don't have all the answers. But it certainly looks different from that of general relativity, but it's getting clearer every day. Thank you. Okay. Well, that's a fair question. What are the prospects? I think the long-term prospects are very good. Well, you have to remember that, you know, general relativity is 90 years old, right? And we are still in the business of testing it. We haven't seen one of its basic predictions of these gravitational waves. We haven't seen it directly. We're still trying to probe the strong field predictions of the geometry around black holes. We had some good tests of sort of the weak field effects from the 1970s from the spacecraft, but that itself was 60 years after the theory was developed. So I think it's just, I mean, this is a theory which is so far removed from what we can currently accept, currently test in the laboratory, that it's, you know, going to be hard to find effects that can say definitively confirm it or rule it out. But I think in the long run, it's always possible. I mean, you could think about proton decay, right? You need to find a new effect, a qualitatively new effect that you can measure. Proton decay was predicted to be a result of these grand unified theories at the characteristic scale of 10 to the 15 GeV. That, again, is very far removed from experiment. You might think it's hopeless to test, but you test it not by taking one proton and waiting, you know, 10 to the 33 years or something, but taking lots of protons and waiting. So string theory might similarly be subject to tests like that when we're able to make definitive predictions, qualitatively new predictions about some effect mediated by string theory, and that we just have to sort of take a lot of matter and wait. But we're not at the point where we can make such definitive predictions yet. Hard to say. Cosmology is, you know, doing impressive things these days, and of course it has a natural high-temperature laboratory at the Big Bang. There are people who are speculating that we might be able to see effects of quantum gravity or string theory in particular from the Big Bang. I think they're still pretty controversial, and sort of still people are working out the details. So I don't know. We'll have to see.
Very good talk.